Hi, and welcome to the 99th episode of the Machine Ethics Podcast. This time, we're talking with Pinar Gavanch. This episode was recorded on the 14th of March, 2025. In this episode, we chat about the Sauer Studios podcast, What's Wrong With? Co-design, inclusive design, responsible design, and what is design? Also, is AI ready for society, or is society ready for AI? Co-creation with AI as a stakeholder or moderator in the design process. Bias in design. Small language models. Is AI making us lazy? And our digital life and our attention. This episode was really great because we got a chance to do a podcast swap. So we had Pinar on our episode this time, and I'm actually talking on the What's Wrong With podcast on hopefully episode 123. So go check that out. It should be out now or in the next week. Also, just a quick note to say, we had extreme internet issues with this episode. So a bit like Rachel Caldicott's episode 98, please bear with it. It is a good listen and I'm hoping you'll get something out of it. But bear in mind, we did chop out some sections and we did actually have to start and stop a few times to let the internet or sort the internet out. So thanks again for bearing with us. If you like this episode, you can find more machine-ethics.net. You can contact us, hello@machine-ethics.net. You can follow us on Blue Sky, machine-ethics.net. Instagram, Machine Ethics Podcast. You can find us on YouTube at machine-ethics. And if you can, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machine-ethics. Thank you so much, and I hope you enjoy. So, Pinar, thank you for coming to the podcast. If you could introduce yourself, who you are, and what do you do?
Thanks, Ben, for having me. I'm Pinar Gavanch. I wear multiple hats, one of them being I run design strategy at Sauer, which is a mission-driven studio addressing social and urban problems. With that, we recognize that it's a very big mission. So at the core of everything we do, we practice co-design. And that's the only way we could actually address our mission. So with that, some other stuff that feeds that, because I'm a practitioner of co-design, I also educate in the space. I teach inclusive design at the School of Visual Arts and MFA Interaction Design in New York City. And I also teach ethical design leadership at Parsons School of Design in Master's in Strategic Design and Management. In additional hats, I also serve on the board of a nonprofit called Open Style Lab, which was originated as a social service project at MIT, and we turned that into a nonprofit, I think, 2017, and it practices co-design with people with disabilities, just recognizing inclusive design is simply better design. And I also advise businesses that are based in New York City under Pratt Center for Community Development.
A lot of stuff then. So there's a few things. Stuff. There's a few things in there. And we previously had a chat on your podcast as well. So I was very fortunate and it was very gracious for you to interview me. So you guys have a podcast. What's it called?
It is called What's Wrong With? It's a very happy podcast. I promise. It actually originated from, I think it was 2017, we had the idea because we often do expert interviews for our projects or ongoing research at Sauer. And as we were having some of those conversations, we were just like, this is just really good information and just good knowledge. Like, this should be public. And I think that also aligns with our mission in the end. We can't address any of the problems in the world without collective awareness or, raised consciousness. So we had the idea to convert it into a podcast, not taking ourselves that seriously. So we kind of recorded from everywhere, but the conversations are great. And it's been many years now, over 120 episodes now, I think. And we speak with diverse experts, progress makers, and around the world and in many different fields, really just having a little bit diagnostic conversations around the underlying reasons of the problems we see today and then talking about solutions or better ways of doing things better.
Where we start on the podcast is with this awful question of AI, and then what we'll do is we'll loop back to some things you were talking about. So to you, what is this idea, this thing, this practice, this technology of AI?
Oh, that's such an evolving answer, Ben. I feel like if you asked me this question several years ago, I would be like, oh my God, you know, I'm such an AI optimist. I want to be like Iron Man. I want to have Jarvis and I want to like save the world and do better with, you know, with all this like super intelligence I have. And I think as we are working more in the space around responsible, ethical, inclusive AI, I'm still an optimist, I think, but I'm a way more cautionary optimist in the sense that I think, you know, in the end, humans have evolved by developing tools and we're very good at it. And AI as a tool is, you know, incredible. It can superpower us in so many ways and help us actually address many of the problems that, you know, we're facing today. However, there is a huge problem in how this tool is envisioned by a handful of people in the world, how development of it is happening, and how it is being released out into the world. And so AI, like sometimes we hear like, oh, you know, AI for good, or we villainize AI. AI is not the problem. You know, I think processes, systems, and even sometimes humans around it is the problem. And that is making me worried in the sense that when we talk about AI, we're not addressing the ecosystem and the problems that might come with that when we are thinking of its future. And this, I think, made us even more passionate. I mean, when we talk about social problems, which is, you know, very inherent to what we do at Sour, obviously, this is something we're seeing major social problems, if not, you know, urban problems through what we're doing to the environment. This is an area that we started to get into even more and more. And I feel like we should have almost full attention to in the near future just because of the concerns we have and, you know, what is waiting for us in the near future.
Yeah. So it's you've kind of done that kind of flip on your thinking around AI at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was, so there's this association called ICI. It basically looks into safety and ethics in AI. And their conference was part of AI Action Summit in February, and I was there. And the event felt like, I mean, it was like planning for the last line of defense, you know, like it's very, very concerning for all the reasons that are not about AI, right? It's more around we're trying to push something into society which is not ready to be pushed, nor the society is ready to ingest, right? Or actually doesn't even need to ingest. Or we are, you know, it's one area that is zero regulated, also our current government. There are principles and standards by some institutions, but I guess like the challenge of those is similar to SDGs, like how does that translate into my day-to-day? For an engineer or a, you know, product developer who is crunched with timelines and deadlines and is serving capitalism, has to serve capitalism to make money, like how does that show up for that person in their day-to-day almost work habits, right? Like there's no actionable insights or tools being translated, or it's very few from these principles, guidelines, standards. And I know, you know, you and I chatted about like how does ethics become practical, right? Like we need, there's no clarity on that or even localized solutions for that. So those are very concerning to me with the push towards AGI as well. And I think we just need to create much higher awareness around what's going on or what might happen. Because sometimes people give the example of like, oh, you know, but in aviation, for example, people didn't use right away because they wanted to see, you know, there's more safety standards or regulations around it to feel safe. And the difference in that, though, is like, it's not like people are needing to go to an airport and get on a plane physically and then, you know, levitate from the ground and like fly. It's in our pockets. Like, it's coming into our pockets through our phones. It is much more addictive and much more easy to access. So we have never in human history have faced anything like this before. Mm-hmm. Something that comes close is social media. And we saw what that did to Gen Z, where, you know, the parents did not understand yet the implications. It was too new, and suddenly Gen Z was like full access, all on board. And now we're having studies around the implications of that to youth, and I don't think we're learning from taking those learnings enough and applying in this case. And in this case, I think the threats are way higher than social.
Yeah, definitely. I think the stakes in those terms are extremely high, right? If we're going to use it for in conjunction with maybe selling things to people or pushing content on people harder, faster, sending messages to all sorts of people in different ways to tailor to them, then, you know, that whole Cambridge Analytica thing, but like on steroids, let's do that again, but like harder with AI. Like that's the thing. So I don't know, like what I wanted to, because all that's kind of concerning that we were talking about just there, I wanted to kind of loop back a little bit and then work our way back into that stuff. So what I wanted to do is give the listeners a general kind of sense, like, what kind of things do you mean when you're saying design, and then and then walk forward into like how does co-design work, inclusive design work in that frame?
I mean, when you think about it, everything around us is designed, right? You can think about the city, you can think about the retail shop you're in, you can think about products, you can think about systems, processes, services, right? Everything is designed. And I think this also kind of made sense to me when we were first saying like, oh, we practice co-design, designers would get offended a little bit. Well, we're designers, you know, like, what are you talking about? And I think this is kind of like reminding us that design is not necessarily just a shiny object, right? It's the output of a process. So co-design, I think, reminds us that design is a process. And within that process, there's so much you can do to create more authentic outcomes. And so it actually design calls for the design of the process. And that's what inclusive design really centers, acknowledging that, you know, it is better design if we design with people who are stakeholders, and not only in, you know, in professional realm, but also through their lived experiences. And they are equally as important as the professional designer, because if not more, because you can't necessarily go to a school for a lived experience. Right? You only have that if you lived it. So really designing with people who are impacted by the outcomes, and really it's a mindset of seeing the expertise equal, right? Professional and experience. And so inclusive design centers that understanding and mindset, and really recognizes that it is better outcomes if we design with people, and how we do that also needs to be inclusive, right? If you are bringing on diverse stakeholders into the process, what that process looks like will evolve from project to project. And also the constraints you're in will change, right? So you might have different timelines on projects, different budgets, different capabilities. And with that, you're designing the process. Okay. Do I need to create a co-creation panel? How many times can I engage this panel? When do I need to engage the panel to make sure I'm reaching insights that are authentic, right? Not just actionable, but actually resonates with all impacted stakeholders. When do I do co-ideation, right? Like even to my students today, when I talk about co-ideation, they try to go with prototypes. I'm like, why do you have a design, right? Like, because the traditional design practice does a little bit of research in the beginning, which is generally exploitative, right? When you consider how research is done today, or really poor research. Focus groups, right? Very sterile environments. You go in with 55 questions and with questions like, how does that make you feel from 1 to 10? And you're like, 7. Right? Like that's, and then we disappear for like 2 years. And then we go in for like the final prototypes testing, which already is too late to incorporate whatever feedback you're getting. So you do marginal changes and that's it, right? So I think the myth around inclusive design is like, oh, it will take longer, it will be more expensive. Actually, you are like 50% ahead because the insights you're landing on are so much more accurate. And because you're building the relationship with the communities that you're designing with throughout the process, you actually iterate faster and you don't necessarily involve people in at the end. You're ideating together, you're involving them in first iteration, second iteration. And so I think when we set, this is changing compared to 5-6 years ago when we used to think with the design or co-design, it's, oh, like this is a social responsibility thing, or like engage communities a little bit, but it might, what do we mean by engagement, right? It's not sending a survey. So I think it's just a better design process, which is not a nice to have, it's a must have. And currently where we are at today in the world, it's all merely a survival strategy because we have so many complex issues in the world that we cannot be naive and things like, oh, this tech team in this room is going to design it all by themselves and it's going to be awesome. Or, you know, any like architects creating a space, urban planners creating a city, right? I think we see in urban design, for example, we would understand and recognize diverse stakeholders and there's more intent to engage in the process, but the current practices are still not that efficient, right? That, what does engagement look like? Because also in co-design, facilitation and curation of the kind of the co-creation team is extremely important. And the more you do it, the better you get at it, right? So it calls for facilitating diverse feedback. Sometimes there's a lot of distrust, right? So how do you mediate those conversations? Sometimes there's a lot of baggage. There's actual trauma. So how do, who do you bring in to make sure you're doing a trauma-informed work? Sometimes, you know, whatever people are saying needs to be translated by the professionals. So how good we are in synthesis, right? I feel like synthesis currently is the weakest muscle in any organization. That's why we're not short of data, right? Companies are sitting on a pile of data, but we don't know what to do with that because either it's not good data, right? Or messy data. I think AI is raising the awareness and like, oh, we need to be good data custodians. So that's changing.
Yeah.
But how inclusive or representative that data is, and then from there to what do we do with that data? And we're actioning, you cannot action on the data, right? You kind of need to synthesize that, like, and are we able to do that really? And also, you know, I think recognizing that, you know, in the past, designers, engineers went into communities, asked questions, disappeared, never showed up, never, not even like acknowledged, but also like paid for that expertise that they're not going to get anywhere else, right? So if you think, if we're thinking lived experience is equally as important as professional, these people need to be paid as consultants, right? But so the myth of that is like, oh, it's going to be more expensive. Actually, you're not going to mess it up in the end. So it's way cheaper for you to do it this way. So I think we're trying to, there's a lot of in practicing this raising awareness, but sometimes I feel like we're also like design spies a little bit because like, oh, if the client is not ready to ingest all of that, we'll just do it, right? And then we'll be within our budget. We don't have to raise any like unfamiliar things. We do it anyway. And then when the, once the client sees outcomes or how quality, like high quality the research is, they are already converting, but we
yeah
instead of trying to convince them in the beginning, we just prefer showing them. But I think this is only feasible because we do this in every project. So we're faster at it. And given the constraints, we can still maneuver. And the relationships that we've built over time across the world through different community-based organizations, we're able to be very agile. But it's definitely, I mean, you know, I think we talked about this before. In whatever problem you see in the world today, they're like, we need to collaborate as an answer. Mm. I feel like saying the word collaboration without defining what it means should be banned because it's such a loose term and it doesn't mean anything anymore. Because just because two plus parties came together doesn't mean you're collaborating, right? Collaboration by dictionary definition calls for having shared goals, and you can only reach that if you have a shared process, right? Because people, if something is not feasible, people understand it's not feasible, right? But you need to land on that together to then ideate, okay, what else is feasible, right? But if you disappear for a while and show up last second, we did this, everyone's like, well, that's not what we told you. Why did you do that, right? So it's really understanding, building relationships, designing a process, what this process interventions or adaptability look like, and really simply enabling effective collaboration, which is like urgently needed today.
Yeah. And I guess from my point of view, there's what you're saying is that this way is going to give you better outcomes, right?
1000%. And you can call whatever you want, right? Like there are cousin languages around this, like participatory design, generative design, inclusive design, co-design.
Yeah.
It all aims for the same thing, right? You utilize participatory methods in an inclusive design process. Yeah. So I think people sometimes get stuck in the vocabulary, but not like the, we need to understand the main point.
I think I'm gonna try you now. I'm gonna try and, so we've got this basis of participatory, inclusive design. I'm just gonna say design, that's fine. We're gonna pretend that designers understand, like from where I'm, okay, this is a mini rant, right? From when I started doing design work, it was the beginning of this wave of like design thinking, and the wave of design thinking, which was this kind of like branded kind of package of things that you could do within design, was to do with user research and UX and this new language around UX and user experience. And I was kind of like, but I understand that there are tools and methods and stuff like that, and that's cool. But like, are you just not designing with people in mind? Are all the designers not designing for people? Like before this thing was branded design thinking and UX, were people just not paying attention to the users, like at all? Like
it
blew my mind. I was like, I'm sure we do design for humans, don't we? So I was always kind of like a dead against that sort of thing, but really into some of the methods and the ideas. It's just I was like, well, this is what you should be doing anyway. I digress. So I'm going to blow your mind for a second. Okay, ready for this? So you've just outlined all the stuff that you can participate in this design process, and and it's all about this process for better design, for better outcomes for humans, etc. What happens when AI is one of the stakeholders? What is designing with AI like, or how does that work, and how does that change that relationship, and does that already factor into some of your work?
100%, yes. And I do think AI should be a co-creator at any project from now on, right? In the end, when we look at today's large language models, they were trained on 50 trillion human decisions, right? So I don't have that capacity, nor any other human can. So why don't we have it as an ideator? But the risk, the huge risk and trap that we're falling into is designing with just AI, right? So co-design aims to decentralize power. You might have an output identified by the client or the brief. You can still try to reframe and challenge that brief through your research process. But throughout the process, by doing co-ideation or synthesizing and going in like, do these make sense to you? You're you are bringing people into the process. Along with that, when you have diverse stakeholders in the process, you are managing bias, right? So bias is very human. I don't like when people say, like, we eliminate bias. There's no such thing. There's always bias, right? I'm clearly biased as sour, right? I have my sour biases. I have my biases as Pinar. But I can manage it if I have diverse biases at the table, right? So when you do that along with the group throughout the process, we're constantly checking each other, right, on our assumptions and biases. And so when you just have AI in the process, it is not that different, right? Like, AI is a super brain that can ideate with us, but we can also check in on its biases. AI can check in on our biases. And also, we could use it as a moderator at times to decentralize the power, or we could go see what powers are driving AI, right? So it's almost like hedging the risk, right? Like, of reaching an outcome that we, and this happens all the time, especially the as companies get bigger, I think then you have this professional bias that, oh, we're so big, we should be able to do it all. We know it all. We're so big, we're so good. And then you're running these projects in such insular way, completely out of touch, right? With like people, all other people but you, right? And I don't even want to say user, because like us, I never understood user-centered design, because it's like us versus them, right? This kind of makes that no. And then human-centered design tried to eliminate that, but then it turned into customer-centered design. And so like you have these processes internally that are not sustainable for teams, but then you're like, you know, and some companies are proud of that. Amazon states were customer centric. It doesn't sustain, right? What does that do to your own team? So I think when you have that really diverse point of view and diverse team, it is easier to manage AI, but AI is a tool, right? If anything, I feel like in the future, we should be using small language models customized to the topic that we're working on and have that as a collaborator rather than a ChatGPT who can go wild and say many different things or can make elementary school level like synthesis, which, you know, never use. And this is for my students if they're listening, never use AI now for synthesis. It's horrible. Use it for like summaries, analysis, whatever, right?
Yeah.
But I 100% think it should be a collaborator, because that's the point of the tool, right? But if we blindly rely on what it's telling us, I mean, we're already done. Like, you wouldn't blindly, like, you would, if you asked me something, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't blindly trust me, like, oh, yeah, Bernard said this, then we're going to do it, right? I wouldn't trust the person who just met me, like, 10 minutes ago and, like, you know, trust me completely. So don't do that to AI.
Yeah. That is sound advice right there. I'm sure you've seen this as well as I have. I feel like we have the trappings of AI thrust upon us at the moment in all systems, all digital spaces which can possibly have it. It is there. Like, how do you feel about having these chat or other kind of like abilities in your emails, in your writing applications, in your scheduling applications, like in every nook and cranny?
I mean, scheduling, I love. I'm not gonna lie, like, there are things where clearly does not require my unique characteristics, right? Like that automation, 100% we should already do it. You know, like, now. One thing about that is I think there's a huge conversation that is not being had enough around upskilling people who do the work that will be automated very soon, right? So what are organizations doing to prep people for that? I think is very important. So again, going back to, there's a huge piece of continuing education on tech, because it's every day, like, something is happening right now. As we're speaking, things are going to change, right? I mean, for grammar check, again, 100%, right? But when it starts completing my sentences on my behalf, you lose the opportunity of like, wait, was I going to say something else, right? Like, when it starts making decisions on my behalf, even like, I would rather write a very rough draft of something and upload it and kind of have like it create five different versions of what I said and reflect on that and continue a bit more if I'm going to use for writing, then having saying like giving the topic, write an essay about this. Because like, what am I good for if I'm not exercising my own brain, right? Like, how do I come to my own insights in something if I stop thinking about it? And that's the biggest problem I also have with like summarizing books. And I've tried this a few times. I would read a book and then I would ask, and different, like you can try this with different large language models, right? But let's say it's ChatGPT. If you ask for it to summarize so many things that I landed on through my reading, it's not there. Right. Mm. Let's say AI knows you more over time and decides on your behalf also that these are the insights that you would land on from this. Right. Possible that maybe there's like 80% overlap. Mm. Right. But maybe there was going to be this one thing that I was going to derive, because in the end, ChatGPT does not have my lived experience. Mm. Right. Unless I like put in, so day one, I was born, this happened, then this happened, I learned this, like, unless you really train AI like that, how is it going to know? Right. Like there's all these possibilities it's trying to land on, but that unique connecting the dot or the dot that I might go into in my long-term memory, that is really, really, I mean, it might achieve that in 10 years. Right. But now it won't. Right. That's kind of the, I guess, like with AGI, that's what they're aiming for, right? But at currently what AI is, there's no way it's going to reach that insight. So, and that maybe even like 1% thing that you landed on maybe is the most unique insight you're going to derive out of that reading. And that's going to really inform you tremendously. And I see the value of this as a consultant, right? Like I feel like I'm a better consultant just because I work in so many diverse industries, because the cross-pollination of that learning and the synthesis is so rich. Mm. I think, you know, obviously the trap is like, because we always feel like we have little time for everything, the shortcuts become even more attractive. But I think that there is a huge moment of like self-reflection on why do we have crunch time? How do we repurpose some of the time that we feel like it's valuable, right? Like maybe don't scroll on Instagram for 40 minutes and instead maybe read something, right? Like, so given how much technology starts to dictate on behalf of us, I think we all need also kind of like a behavioral check and a reflection on like, okay, how do I go about my life now? It's a different world. It really is. And it's sneaking upon us unless we're self-aware and reflective on how we're approaching it.
I'm gonna do a sneaky shout out here actually, because one of my friends runs two of my friends run a company and a consultancy called Mind Over Tech, and they actually talk about they have like a card thing that you can do little experiments with yourself, and it's and they also consult with businesses, but it's all around that stuff, like
I love that.
Are you being mindful and reflecting on your phone use and the kinds of things you do on your phone, the kinds of availability you have to communicate with people at certain times of the day? And and it's what is nice about it is that they don't like shame you. It's just kind of like, you know, this practice of which is really cool, because it's quite easy just to go like, you shouldn't do that.
This is
a bad thing that you were doing. But no, it's like, well, you know, you could do this thing, but maybe you internally have thought about maybe doing, you know, learning a language or going and doing some more running or whatever. How are you going to make room for that? You know, how are you going to? So it's more like that, which is nice.
It's good to then like introduce methods to also not people be like self-defensive about things, right? In inclusive design, for example, we start a process doing a positionality exercise, right? Like, how do I show up? Like, who am I? Like, what's my identity? How does that identity show up in my close circle? How does it show up in my corporate self? How do you know, like, you kind of run through this exercise, and it aims to also help serve reflexivity, which is not just like reflecting on who you are, but based on that reflection, how are you going to act next, right? So that reflexivity exercise, I think it's like ongoing in an inclusive design process, and it's so much more important in the day and age we are in, you know, because we are constantly pulled in 100 different directions for our attention. It's taking out a lot of our energy in things that do not even deserve our energy, right? Like, yeah, if you look at the news today, and we're not being reflective, right? That, like, there's huge value in these, like, subtleties across the day or in a day, and just reflecting and being mindful, especially when everything else is moving so, so fast.
Do you have, like, obviously a lot of your work is to do with empowering people to make products which are good to, you know, reflect well for them and do better in the marketplace because of that fact. We're having a lot of upheaval at the moment, governmental upheaval. I don't know if you've seen it. You're obviously in the States at the moment. I'm in the UK, and we're having similar conversations actually at the moment about bureaucracy and technologies. And how do you feel about that in terms of those people, maybe those less abled or those people who are less represented, and how that, you know, obviously we can think of technology sometimes as a big hammer to hit things with. So have you got any thinking around maybe AI, but maybe that use of technology in the social sphere?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Clearly, I'm coming from sour. So it's going to be very, very tough 4 years. People who are working in civic tech, right? And obviously, that's extremely concerning, because already we're not in a system that has any guardrails or safety measures. And now we're losing people in those spaces who could actually implement some of those or make more conscious, mindful, and logical decisions. So with that, I think, and I talked about this to my students recently, because obviously when you look at the big picture, sometimes it gets so paralyzing, right? Like, and I think that's the trap that sometimes, I mean, I feel like I used to do this a lot to myself too. And I like looking at systems view, but when you see the system, then you see all the problems. And sometimes it's like, what do I do now? Or you feel so hopeless. And that's exactly what they want you to feel. So I think in those moments, there's huge value in zooming in, right? Zooming into those moments of interaction, the processes, who you're speaking with, what you're doing, and start thinking about these micro interventions on, well, how can I reframe this problem so it resonates with my boss, right? How do I... you know, if I was given kind of like a research project, how do I diversify the pool a little bit on my own effort, right? To make sure we're getting diverse insights. And that comes with more work and more responsibility, right? Like, that's because nothing is making this easier for us. But I think for people who are able to practice design or who is in tech development, like, it's almost like, okay, we lost the AI initiatives. Now HR is going to be completely exclusive. Does not make any sense, right? There's so much personal, professional ethics that you can implement in your work that we shouldn't feel disempowered to execute that. But I think we need to be very smart and strategic in how we're communicating those. We can't, like, it's not about converting people's beliefs, right? There's an incredible author on cognitive bias, David Dylan Thomas, Design for Cognitive Bias is his book. Shout out to him. And we talked about this recently with him as well. Like, he was giving an example of, I think this was in UK even, where this person really wanted a law not to pass just because it would have been detrimental to the planet, right? But she didn't spend time in trying to convince them that climate change is real. She just reframed that and started talking about the implications of property taxes that might come into place if that law shall pass, right? So I think us designers especially, or even people in it, like, my background is in engineering. My career led me to evolve into design strategy. We're not necessarily taught to, like, okay, strategic communications, right? Like, taxes, crisis management, like, these things that are actually really relevant to our world, like, looking at how chaotic it is. we're not equipped with those, right? So I think it's really important to think about, like, okay, when I do it, make a presentation, maybe it's a more inclusive solution, right? But I understand, if anything, it's inclusive storytelling. Understand your audience. What do they care about? What do they value? Mm-hmm. What keeps them up at night? And what, how do I tell this to them, right? Like, for example, we work on this, like we work a lot with people with disabilities in diverse areas, from tech to consumer goods, right? And if I were to go and talk about, like, you know, people with disabilities have historically been overlooked or underserved, mm-hmm. so we need to do this, I'm not going to get a good response, right? But if I go in and say the annual purchasing power of people with disabilities, which is the largest minority in the world, mm-hmm. is equivalent of China, right? If not more, with their families. And we have a growing aging population, right? So, like, yeah. those become more interesting conversations, right? So I think we always need to be savvy about what is the business use case, mm-hmm. if we want to play the capitalism game.
Yeah,
right.
I think we talk about this extensively in our episode, yeah. where you're, and it sounds like we're playing that game, right? You're saying
100%. Yeah. Like, I think in the moment, right, I don't think it can be only playing the game, mm. but I think if we want to see shift in the future, there's huge value in small actions, short-term solutions today, because mm. then it becomes the normal. Oh yeah, we do design with people with disabilities. See, even though that company did it. So how do we start creating these, like, case examples, and how do we become allies? I think allyship has been, I mean, it has always been important, but it's yep. more important today than ever. You just be a good human, you know, and just support people. And think about it as good karma, or whatever religion you believe in, right? Like, it's just good practice.
Yeah, I feel like that's, in my head, when you said that, I felt like the allies language and that language of the LGBTQ plus community has been sort of hijacked into the woke conversation now.
Yeah.
And woke being this kind of, you know, derogatory slang term, really, you know, it's not necessary, you know. So it's unfortunate, because we want to be allies, but essentially what we're saying is we want to be empathetic human beings to our fellow
empathetic
human beings, you know what I mean,
and translate into action. I got questions, like, because I'm on the board of Open Style Lab, that, you know, centers people with disabilities at its work, like, they're like, oh, so what is your connection to disability? I'm like, that I care.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's, I think we just, and this is kind of the users, developers, right? Like, the us versus them. Like, mm-hmm. guys, there's a thing called overview effect, which apparently only 500 people have in the world, because those are the people who left the world and, like, saw the world from top down, from space.
Right. Yeah.
And when you're there, you're kind of like, where are you from? Well, I'm from Earth. Right. Like, and then suddenly everybody's from Earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like, when you're here, so many adjectives just, like, kind of dilute that, you know. If I'm suffering, it's not helping you in some way. This is all interconnected, and you really need to understand that.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a false dichotomy. It's no us and you, you know.
Exactly.
You know, it doesn't make any sense, really. Cool. Well,
I don't even know if this is helpful for anyone.
I'm not sure if we've solved it, but it's an interesting conversation.
Start with exposing yourself to someone you never have, and just have conversations. Like, start having conversations without being triggered. I think that's where ethical frameworks actually help a lot, right? Because then you could be on total different point of views, but you're not, like, escalating or getting angry, because you're approaching it subject from a different ethical lens, right? So you're just discussing from different dimensions. Start with that, right? Go out of your own bubble and comfort zone and get into different spaces, talk to diverse people, just see their point of view. I think that's, like, at the very minimal, what we should all do, really.
Yeah. Well, that's great advice. I think that's great advice for any situation, non-designers.
Anyone.
So do you, I'm going to give you a funny one. Do you have any tips for podcasters who want to podcast?
That's great. So don't get ads.
Don't make money. Don't do a good job.
go on ranting. Question: we record from anywhere in the world. And because you're on a podcast, also, you know, you have to have that conversation. So you will have to listen, and you will have to respond and ask a question.
Yep. So for our last question, we ask, you know, what is exciting you, and what is maybe making you a bit more fearful about AI and our mediated future?
Well, I think I talked a lot about fears, so maybe I will focus on the positive.
Yeah, sure.
I am excited to have AI as a collaborator in design process, just to supercharge us, and especially in a context where we're always crunched on time, right? Like automating some of the things that don't require any human insight into. I am excited that it could do so much in diagnostic space, right? Like especially healthcare, I'm really excited about. I'm also like kind of the silver lining of all of it is like, you know, and I think we talked about a little bit before together, like how the harm or the cost of, you know, being wasteful, we noticed maybe in like 50, 60 years, even though the experts involved understood that might happen. AI is so fast, and therefore it's kind of raising all these issues into our faces so fast as well. It's a great mirror to the society in our own biases and prejudices and how we work ineffectively. So I'm hoping I can put my designer cap on and reframe that as an opportunity to address those biases and ineffectiveness in systems, and really then push ourselves to be more responsible of what data are we producing and what does that look like? What visuals am I producing and what does that look like? What written content am I producing and what does that look like? Understanding anything we put out into the world has implications, right? Mm. And it goes into a massive pool, but it drives the narrative and the decisions that maybe we might disagree with. So I think it is pushing us to be much more responsible and aware of our actions, like design outputs or, you know, product outputs. So I'm excited about that in a way that hopefully we can manage to translate into responsible action.
I think what you said there is really interesting, actually. You know, on top of that, which is, you know, you're putting stuff out there, and it's, you know, you should be mindful of those things, but also like that is data that you're producing that might be getting put into these systems, and it goes round and round, you know. So try and push good things into that system.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much for your time. If people want to contact you, follow you, how do they do that?
They can find me on LinkedIn. They can write hello at sour.studio and say, I listened to your conversation with Ben. And someone will make sure that email will reach me.
Awesome. So thank you very much for your time, and I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you, Ben. Bye.
Hello, and welcome to the end of the podcast. Thanks again to Pinar for coming on the podcast. And also thanks for having me on the What's Wrong With podcast. If you want to check that out, that's me talking about AI, ethics, and probably a lot of ranting about capitalism. Hope you enjoyed the episode where we talked a lot about design and inclusive design and design methodologies. For our 100th episode next time, we'll be deep diving into AI and the environment. So please look forward to that. Tell your friends, support us on Patreon. I'm really excited about how this deep dive episode is coming together. And if you'd like to check out our last deep dive episode, it was episode 65, Deep Dive AI and Games. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll speak to you next time.